This is Michael Leary with More Than Meets the IRB from the Human Research Protection Office at Washington University in St. Louis. More Than Meets the IRB is a series dedicated to current issues in research ethics from the perspective of research participants and the people who study them. Today I'd like to introduce Dr. Robert Nelson. We're very happy that you are joining us today for this installment to talk about the ethics of involving children in research.
Well, thanks, Michael. I'm happy to join you.
Dr. Nelson is the Deputy Director and Senior Pediatric Ethicist of the FDA Office of Pediatric Therapeutics. Dr. Nelson has served on the Secretary Advisory Committee on Human Research Protections and many other federal committees related to the protection of human subjects in research, particularly children. You are very uniquely positioned to talk to us today about what's current in the field of pediatric research ethics and what we need to know about where the FDA is on that map. But I'd like to start with a very general question, because we do talk a lot about the possibility that some participants may be more vulnerable than others in the context of research, such as prisoners or the decisionally impaired or children. Given your experience in pediatric research ethics, do you think that children have any unique vulnerabilities? And if so, how should we best define the vulnerability of children?
Well, Michael, the notion of vulnerability was first proposed from the perspective of someone being unable to consent for themselves or being in a position in which they are vulnerable, if you will, to undue influence or coercion given their situation, which would lead to people that are in positions of power or are relatively powerless compared to others. In pediatrics, the notion is that children can't make their own decision about going into a clinical trial, but are dependent upon the decision of others as to whether it's appropriate to expose them to research risk. Now, we can take vulnerability and develop it further, but I think that's the core concept.
So it really is a matter of consent and undue influence, and how do we know that a child actually is willing to participate in a study or not?
Well, that's right, and that gets to the notion of assent, but the sort of starting point before we even get to where we would approach child assent is asking the question as to whether it's even appropriate to expose a child to that risk. And it's in this context that the National Commission developed the additional safeguards for children that we currently call Subpart D.
Okay, let's talk about some of those safeguards from the perspective of a very particular context, that being Phase 1 pediatric trials. For those of you who are joining us, a phase one trial happens at the beginning of the study of a drug or device. It's the very initial stages of clinical research. And a phase one trial is occurring before we actually know much about potential risks and benefits involved. So given the regulatory framework regarding the risk and benefit analysis that takes place during the review of research that involves children, how can we balance the inherent risk of clinical research on children with the need to advance science in these areas?
So, Michael, let me first give a general framework about the additional protections in Subpart D and then apply it to Phase 1 drug trials.
Okay.
So the additional protections have two major components. If there's no prospect of direct benefit to the child who's enrolled in the research, the risks of that intervention or procedure must be low. And we use the language of either minimal risk or minor increase over minimal risk for children with a disorder or a condition to describe that general category of low risk. And then for interventions or procedures that present more than a minor increase over minimal risk, we require that there must be some prospect of direct benefit that's sufficient to justify those risks, and that's roughly comparable to the available alternatives. So when I think about phase one drug trials, the way I describe these two categories, the low risk and then the higher risk, is as two different pathways. And so let me try to explain that. A phase one drug trial, or trial of biologic for that matter, is focused on trying to find the right dose to move into further testing in phase two or phase three. Phase two being sort of proof of concept, phase three being that pivotal trial that really tells you that something is safe and effective. Mm-hmm. So the question is, if you've got a a drug that you're giving, do you have enough data on hand to know that the risk of giving that to a child is low? In other words, no more than a minor increase over minimal risk, and therefore you don't have to worry about the possibility that that child may benefit from that drug, even though you need to give it to a child who has a disorder or a condition.
So there's a certain data threshold for qualifying something as being on the low-risk pathway at that point.
Right. I mean, if you don't have any data, how do you make that decision?
Yes, yes.
You know, one example would be, say, pharmacokinetic studies of over-the-counter cough and cold products. That arguably would be a minor increase over minimal risk. We need studies to look at the right pharmacokinetics of that of those drugs. But other drugs that may present greater than a minor increase over minimal risk, we would be unable to use that pathway. Mm-hmm. And so we then have the burden of trying to design a trial that offers that child a prospect of direct benefit.
So then the onus is on the investigator to actually incorporate the vulnerability of children in this context into their actual study design itself.
Right. And that often comes down to the dosing strategy. In other mm-hmm. words, what data do you have either from non-clinical animal models or if there's an adult human equivalent in the disease, what data do you have that the dose you've picked and the dosing regimen that you've elected to give that child offers them a prospect of direct benefit? Now, mind you, that needs to be comparable to the available alternatives. So when we look, for example, in oncology, phase one drug trials in oncology and pediatrics are often children who have failed other phase three or phase two options. And so we're really looking at comparing the possibility of some tumor response to the alternative, which would be no treatment or palliative care. And it's in that context that perhaps a statistical chance of maybe a 6 or 8 or arguably 10% tumor response may be a sufficient prospect of direct benefit, again, assuming the risks are not excessive,
yeah,
to justify the phase 1 drug trial.
Not excessive or comparable to parallel therapy?
Well, in this context, there wouldn't be a comparable drug therapy if you're taking children who have failed other treatments. What I mean by not excessive is, in fact, that tumor response would justify the risks of administering the product.
Okay.
And at least in my experience, a lot of the targeted therapy is perhaps less risky than some of the more classic cytotoxic drugs in oncology.
So it sounds like the other angle on this is what people frequently refer to as scientific necessity. Especially that term comes up a lot when we're talking about evaluating whether we should allow children to participate in phase one pediatric research.
Right.
Can you define scientific necessity in this context? Is there, it seems to be a bit nebulous and it's difficult to apply in a case-by-case situation, but what would be the best way for us to think about this concept of scientific necessity here? Like you just mentioned, in some of these studies, there is a statistical chance of direct benefit involved, which
mm-hmm.
seems to imply that there's some kind of necessity involved with allowing children to engage in this kind of risky research.
Well, so when I think about scientific necessity, I think there's two key concepts. The first is that there's a scientific objective that's important to advance the health and welfare of children. And second is that the enrollment of children must be necessary to, in fact, address that scientific objective.
Okay.
So in other words, that you can't get an answer to your question by either enrolling adults or, you know, for that matter, non-human animals in the case of the animal rule for certain products.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I link this notion of scientific necessity to the requirement for equitable selection. And if you go back to the National Commission's report, and I think it's actually in the Belmont report, where they talk about this notion of adults before adolescents, before younger children,
mm-hmm.
is they link that notion of justice, if you will, to equitable selection, which is one of the requirements for IRB approval under the Subpart A for FDA or the Common Rule. We often think of equitable selection in terms of race and ethnicity, but I think we also need to think about it in terms of age.
That's an intriguing point. And I can really see both of these concepts of that it's necessary for children to be involved and this perspective of equitable selection. I can see both of those concepts being very helpful during the actual IRB review of a difficult protocol in this context. That's a very helpful way to think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move forward to talk a bit about the FDA and its involvement with research involving children, because there's been a few relatively recent bits of legislation that have been passed, and I would like to discuss what those are, maybe have a description of what these acts entail and how successful they might have may have been with current research. The first being the Pediatric Research Equity Act, PREA, which was passed in 2003, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what that act entails and how it's played out in the past 10 years?
Well, so there are two important components of what the FDA does in terms of pediatric product development under legislation. One is PREA, which stands for the Pediatric Research Equity Act. It was first passed in 2003, but that was based on a pediatric rule that the FDA put in place in 1998 okay. that was actually struck down for extending our regulatory authority, and then Congress then gave us that authority in 2003. The other component is called the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act, which was first passed in 1997 and has continued to this date. I'll describe what these are, but I might say that both of these, PREA and BPCA, were reauthorized permanently in 2012 in the FDA Safety and Innovation Act. So they are now a permanent part of the regulatory landscape. What PREA does is it gives the FDA authority to require a sponsor to do pediatric studies for the indication that they are seeking in adults or, for that matter, in a different pediatric population with certain criteria. If it's a new indication, a new formulation, a new dosing regimen, and so forth, there are certain criteria that are triggered by PREA. So, for example, if you're coming in for the adult indication of major depressive disorder, there are children with major depressive disorder that we would have the authority to require a pediatric study.
Okay.
BPCA is where we would request studies. And the difference is that we can request a study on any indication if we think that that product may have a health benefit in children.
And BPCA refers to the Best Pharma for Children Act, correct?
Yes, Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act. The process there is that the sponsor can request through what's called a proposed pediatric study request, or the FDA can initiate what we call a written request. So we basically send a letter to the sponsor. There's also an off-patent process by which we can send that to NIH, and there may be academic investigators involved in NIH trials that are under BPCA as well. But that written request is, in effect, a contract where we say, if you do these things, for the purpose of the sponsor, again, not NIH, but if you do these things, you get an additional 6 months of marketing exclusivity. So let me give you an example of that impact. Sildenafil for the treatment of neonatal pulmonary hypertension. Small population, trials didn't have to be very big, but they got 6 months of marketing exclusivity on the entire moiety, in other words, all of the products that contained sildenafil. They get an additional 6 months of patent protection. So for certain products, the payback can be huge. For other products, it's less so. But yes, that's a very important component of stimulating pediatric product development.
So from your perspective, do you think that these types of regulatory policies, do you think they have stimulated research this direction?
Absolutely. If you go to our website, and let me give you the URL because it's hard to find us given that they've redesigned it, but if you go to the FDA website, www.fda.gov, and then /pediatrics, that will get you directly to our site. The link is a lot more problematic. On that, we list the labeling changes and the studies that have been a result of both PREA and BPCA. There's now, I think, almost 400 labeling changes over the last decade and a half as a result of this legislation. So this is a very successful program. I might add that one important change when these pieces of legislation were made permanent in 2012 was that the requirement to submit a pediatric plan under PREA was moved to the end of phase two. And the goal there is that we have discussions of pediatric product development during the adult development and not after the product's out on the market. Because once a product's out on the market, pediatricians can use things off-label. And the goal is to try and provide advice to pediatricians earlier in that process, perhaps, if appropriate, maybe even at the time of adult licensure.
So that is a pretty significant movement in the commercial research world.
It is. It's a bit of a work in progress since it was only passed last year. I might add one of the other drivers is that the European Medicinal Agency requires a pediatric investigational plan at the end of phase one.
Wow.
So the general trend is that pediatric plans are discussed earlier in product development. Doesn't necessarily mean the studies are done earlier, but at least we have an idea of what needs to be done and can make a decision as to whether or not certain studies ought to be done earlier than after the adult marketing application is approved.
So speaking of progress, what's next? A lot of our listeners are actively involved in the IRB review of research. Many others are simply interested in the world of human research and the ethics that apply. So this is a good chance from someone in your position. I just want to ask, what's next? What can we start thinking about? What sorts of things from an ethical and regulatory perspective should we begin anticipating seeing or adopting in our review process?
Well, I think one of the big developments this year was the publication of the FDA final rule on 21 CFR 50 subpart D, the additional protections for children. This was 10 years in the making. I won't bore you with the regulatory story as to why it took so long. But I'm pleased that in the preamble to that regulation, which was published at the end of February, there's a discussion, and you can find it on our website, by the way, at the URL that I gave you. There's a discussion of how one approaches placebo-controlled trials and the application of component analysis. I'll also mention that there's a presentation on our website that I had given to SACARP on this topic now, I think, last year. And it provides, I think, advice to IRBs about what we, I think, should have been doing as we look at protocols that include both interventions that offer direct benefit and interventions that do not. And so I think that's an important thing for IRBs to think through. And as new protocols come forward or as old protocols come up for continuing review, to just be cognizant of the need to separate out from the protocol those interventions and procedures that don't offer any prospect of direct benefit so that you're appropriately evaluating the risks of those procedures and whether they're acceptable at this minor increase over minimal risk level.
And I'll certainly include a link to that in the description of this podcast on our website so people that are listening will be able to open that up and take a look.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Speaking of the evaluation of risks and benefits, one area that becomes particularly difficult is the evaluation of research that involves children in other countries, which I know more and more IRBs are seeing on a regular basis.
Right.
From your perspective, do you think that this is going to become standard in what we continue to see come through for review? And if so, what are some resources, or just in a very preliminary way, what are some ways that we can begin to wrap our heads around that type of review process?
Let me offer a few thoughts. That's a difficult and complicated topic. But first of all, it is true that pediatric clinical trials are in fact global, that if you look at the trials that would be conducted or FDA regulated, given the nature of the pediatric diseases, the extent to which they're dispersed among large centers, inevitably those trials will be conducted outside of the United States in addition to having U.S. sites. Now, an IRB may or may not be responsible for these other sites, but IRB should be cognizant that there are often many sites involved in these trials. From my perspective at the FDA, I don't generally evaluate the ethics of those trials any differently. In other words, if the FDA says a trial is appropriate, it'd be appropriate in St. Louis just as it would be in Pretoria, South Africa. Where that becomes more complex is if, in fact, the disease may only be able to be studied in other areas, such as HIV. I mean, fortunately, at this point, the prevalence of pediatric HIV in the United States is low enough that those trials are predominantly conducted abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may be unique vulnerabilities that would have to be considered. There may be considerations of what the standard of care is in that area so that one can understand the protocol and how it's being applied. So there may be specific context considerations that have to be taken into account. But I personally don't think we have to sort of relax our ethical vigilance to make sure that we think the trial is appropriate. In many ways, a lot of those contextual issues might, in fact, increase the vulnerability of a population and perhaps lead an IRB to say these are the questions that we want the investigator to answer about that population and perhaps get answers from the community within which that research is being conducted, you know, usually from investigators that are partnering with the academic investigator in the United States, or perhaps even direct communication with the IRB that's responsible at that location.
Yes, and that is a question for an entire conversation, I would think. Perhaps we can do that in the future. This has been a very fascinating and I think very helpful conversation, Dr. Nelson. I'm very grateful that you were able to join us, and I hope that we can talk with you again in the future as well. Obviously, there's far more that we could talk about regarding the involvement of children in research. So thank you for joining us.
Michael, it's my pleasure, and as you said, there are a lot of other topics that we can cover, and I'd look forward to doing that at some other time on your invitation.
This has been More Than Meets the IRB. Thank you for joining us, and we thank the Washington University in St. Louis School of Medicine Office of Public Affairs for their support in this, and we look forward to seeing you next time.